Welcome everyone to Narkis. Shabbat, August the 4th, 2018. And we are still in the triennial parasha. So welcome to the new people here. I'm going to write some things on the board, or references, where we are. Everyone has their own Bible. We are in the book of Numbers, chapter 22, verse 2, and we will go to chapter 23, verse 9. And then if that is the main meal, then we will have a dessert in the prophets, Micah 7, 16, and Isaiah 65.
60.
60, chapter 60. So I will write those on the board. Chapter Micah 7:16 and Isaiah 65.
It's such a weird Micah reading.
Is it?
Yeah, because the whole thing about Balaam and Balak and all things is in Micah 6. And that's why I'm like,
but that's not what it's focusing on, is it? Yeah. So, as these texts are paired together, you see what someone around Jesus' time was focusing on when they read the book of Numbers. What did they choose to emphasize? And so you're right that there are other places in the Bible that speak specifically about Bilam or what happened at Baal Peor. It's even mentioned in Hosea.
Right.
But that isn't what these people focused on. And I think it's a very poetic relationship between these two,
okay.
As we will see. Well, you can read it. You might miss.
No, I said I couldn't read the text.
Oh.
I could just guess it was Micah. So I thought, hey, hallelujah, it must be six.
Well, so now we'll all get to read it together.
Never
mind. Okay, so what we do is we read the text around in the circle if you have English. And if you don't want to read, tell the person next to you, and we'll just keep going. Everyone takes three or four verses until we're done. So Gemma will start us off in Numbers 22, verse 2.
Now Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. And Moab was exceedingly afraid of the people because they were many. And Moab was sick with dread because of the children of Israel. So Moab says to the leaders, elders of Midian, now this company will lick up everything around us as an ox licks up the grass of the field. And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of the Moabites at that time. Then he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, look, a people has come from Egypt.
Amos.
See, they cover the face of the earth and are settling next to me. Therefore, please come at once. Curse this people for me, for they're too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the diviner's fee in their hand, and they came to Balaam and spoke to him the words of Balak. And he said to them, lodge here tonight, and I will bring back word to you as the Lord speaks to me. So the princes of Moab stayed with Balaam.
Said to Balaam, do not go with them. You mustn't put a curse on those people. his eyes so that he could see the angel of Adonai standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand. And he bowed his head and fell on his face. The angel of Adonai said to him, "Why did you hit the donkey 3 times like that? I have come out here to bar your way, because you are rushing to oppose me." The donkey saw me and turned aside these 3 times, and indeed, if she hadn't turned away from me, I would have killed her by now and saved its life.
And Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, "I have sinned, for I did not know you stood in the way against me. Now therefore, if it displeases you, I will turn back." Then the angel of the Lord said to Balaam, "Go with the men, but only the word that I speak to you, that you shall speak." So Balaam went with the princes of Balak. Now when Balak heard that Balaam was coming, he went out to meet him in the city of Moab, which is on the border of the Arnon, the boundary of the territory. Then Balak said to Balaam, "Did I not earnestly send to you, calling for you? Why didn't you come to me? Am I not able to honor you?" And Balaam said to Balak, "Look, I come to you. Now, have I any power at all to say anything? The word that God puts in my mouth, that I must speak." So Balaam went with Balak, and they came to Kiriath Huzot. Then Balak offered oxen and sheep, and he sent some to Balaam and to the princes who were with him. So it was the next day that Balak took Balaam and brought him up to the high places of Baal, that from there he might observe the extent of the people.
23. Yeah. Balaam's first message. Balaam said, "Give me 7 altars here, and prepare 7 bulls and 7 rams for me." Balak did as Balaam said, and the two of them offered a bull and a ram on each altar. Then Balaam said to Balak, "Stay here beside your offering while I go aside. Perhaps the Lord will come to meet me. Whatever he reveals to me, I will tell you." Then he went off to a barren height. God met with him, and Balaam said, "I have prepared 7 altars, and on each altar I have offered a bull and a ram." The Lord put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, "Go back to Balak and give him his word."
So he went back to him and found him standing beside his offering and all the princes of Moab. Then Balaam uttered his oracle. "Balak brought me from Aram, the king of Moab, from the eastern mountains. Come," he said, "curse Jacob for me. Come, denounce Israel. How can I curse those whom God has not cursed? How can I denounce those whom the Lord has not denounced? From the rocky peaks I see them, from the heights I view them. I see a people who live apart and do not consider themselves one of the nations." Is that nine?
Yes. And it, of course, goes on, but our parasha ends here.
For a whole month.
That's right. It's literally a cliffhanger.
It's a real cliffhanger.
They're up on top of the hill,
yeah.
And there we are. Okay. So, if we can, maybe we'll discuss this passage first and then carry on to the other ones. And we'll try not to overdo the discussion because sometimes we run out of time. So we'll try to be good today. So, where are we right now in the narrative? Where are the people of Israel?
Plains of Moab.
Plains of Moab. Where is that today?
Jordan,
yeah. The country Jordan, not the river. But the country Jordan is beyond the river Jordan, the other side. Basically, if you were to jump over the Dead Sea on that side, you would be in Moab. At least the bottom part What are the two markers? I think we talked about it last week. Gary talked about it. There's two borders. What makes the borders of Moab? Wadis. Some translate rivers. Wadi in Hebrew, it's Nahal. These are river beds that aren't always full of water, but sometimes they are. And those form borders. In ancient days, of course, borders were rivers. They were mountains. And we see even in words, the word today for borders, gvul. Also in the Bible, it's gvul. And a related word in Arabic is jabal. For jabal, everyone knows what that means in Arabic? Mountain. So the same word in Hebrew became border and Arabic became mountain, because people use geography to map out the area. That's just a rabbit trail. So we have these two wadi systems that mark out Moab. What has just happened?
Can you remind us which what they
call? Arnon.
Oh, right.
And it should be Yavoh. Yavok, right? Wasn't it Yavok and Arnon? Or is it just Arnon? It was Arnon and something else?
Oh, I see. In 21:14, the books of the Arnon.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
Arnon is the big one. And what is the country above Moab? Or what are the people group above Moab, north of Moab?
Ammonites.
Bnei Ammon. Okay, what is the people group below Moab? Edom, Edomites. So we spent last week, you were talking about Edom, the Edomites, and the history, the relationship. You remember Edom is a twin brother to who? Edom is a twin brother to Jacob. If you take their other names, right? Jacob and Esau are the names we think about when we think about the twin story. But all through those narratives, they're playing on their other name. And of course, Jacob's other name is Israel. And Esau's other name is Edom, Edom. So Edom and Israel are twin brothers, and they have a very strange relationship. We have in the Bible says, don't hate an Edomite because he is your brother, right? Mm-hmm. However, by the time you get to Obadiah, we read about, Edom is just all terrible, is bad, because he betrayed his brother. It's a very offensive sin. He gave up the brother to the invading enemy, the strong force that was, the superpower that was coming to invade. And so they have this, when Israel is up, Edom is down. When Edom's up, Israel is down. It's very conflicted relationship. So that's Edom. Who else is down south, lower than Edom, to the east side of Yam Suf? Well, Amalek is in that whole lower area of the Negev. Amalek, though, does not have a land. And Amalek is one of the tribes of Edom. It's counted, just like Israel has 12 tribes, Edom has 12 tribes. They really are twins.
So it's practically Egypt.
And one of Edom's descendants is Amalek, who is the epitome of evil when you read him throughout the Bible. But Amalek has no land. Amalek is a nomad. There is no inheritance. There's no land area that is, this is the land. Once we have in the Bible, Ir Amalek, but there are some textual issues there as well, and it's maybe that was at some time they settled with someone else. But historically, they don't have a land, they don't have a king, they're just nomads. But there is a group of people south of Edom. Now, you're going to Egypt, but that is west. I'm asking what's to the east. What's under Edom? It's off your map. I'm asking for your memory.
Well, I said Egypt because I don't.
No, Egypt's that way. What's that way? Saudi Arabia. What would have been there in Moses' time? Who lived in Saudi Arabia and just above it? I'll give you a hint. Their names are mentioned in this story. It's not Moab, it's...
Amorites.
What?
Amorites.
Ah, Emori is a different name. That's with Midian. Yay, we got it. Midian. When you hear Midian, that's down south. Think of the area of Eilat. Midian. So beneath Edom. Edom, we think of maybe parts of the Negev. We think of Petra. We were talking about that yesterday. Many of the prophecies talk about Edom being a fortress up in the rocks, secure. You think you'll never fall, but I'll bring you down from there. So we talked about Petra's other name in Hebrew is Sela, which means bedrock. It's like a rocky fortress. So where is Petra today? What country?
Jordan.
And because there are modern borders, it tends to feel like so far away, but it's very, very close. You can go there on a day trip. So, and right now the people of Israel are in modern-day Jordan. They're in the plains of Moab. And what has just happened? Who are the people they have battled? Who was here last week? Who can tell me something from last week? Og and Sihon. They were two kings. Where were they kings of?
Og is in the north, king in the Golan.
Yes? Where? What's it called?
Bashan.
Bashan. And what?
The
king of Amorites. Okay. Amorites can be generic as well, but up in the Bashan area. So, Gilad and Bashan, there are areas that start in the north to the east of the Kinneret and all the way down to the Dead Sea, that whole strip. And these are battles that Israel had. Well, they also fought Edom. Right? They also fought Edom. In both cases, they were trying to go through the land, and they were not permitted to. And so they had a battle. And why do I bring this all up? Because it's significant to our first verses here in Numbers 22:2. Who is Balak?
The king of the Moabites.
King of the Moabites. And apparently he is the new king of the Moabites. And so some interpreters have said, you know, he got put in place because the other one got captured, and he really didn't have the qualifications. He was just kind of a necessary king. I don't know. That's, of course, reading between the lines. But there he is. He's a king of Moab. And what does he see?
Big, too strong for him coming to attack him.
And he sees specifically everything Israel had done to the Emori, to the Amorites. So he sees it, or he hears about it, I don't know. And what is his response?
That's cursing.
No, before that. What does it say in verse 3? Okay, you have filled with dread. Sick with fear. Anyone else?
Sick with dread.
Sick with dread. Something else. Anyone?
Exceedingly afraid.
Exceedingly afraid. Okay, good. So, I just closed my tab. So, it uses a particular word to be afraid. Yeah, it's not the generic word. It says Vayago. Sorry, I need to find. I closed the tab here. I have to reopen it. Gul, not in the sense of living, in the sense of fearing. There's many different kinds of ghouls. Okay. Ghoul, Vayago. La ghoul is one of your words for fearing. It only comes 10 times in the Bible, though. It's a very specific word, you could say. And it so happens, where else do we see this word? Wait, why isn't it? Ah, okay. That's also a very specific word. There's two words that they use here that are specific. The first, Vayago, is kind of a poetic word. We get it in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 1:17, Deuteronomy 18:22. And it's interesting in Deuteronomy 18, whenever a prophet speaks in my name and the prediction is not fulfilled, then I have not spoken it. The prophet has presumed to speak, so you need not fear him. There's that word, lo tagur. You won't be afraid of him. So there's a sense of, it's that kind of like, the dreadful kind of fear. Okay, Saul has this fear. And in Hosea, it's used. The people of Samaria, you know, when the north broke away and they were worshiping their own thing, and they set up calf idols, and one was in Beit El, that Hosea calls Beit Aven, the house of nothingness. And says the people of Samaria will fear.
Hosea what?
Hosea 10:5. Fear in the sense of mourning over it, maybe, or dreading. So this kind of fear is very ominous. And it comes in Job, and it comes in Psalms. So really, let's see, twice in Job, twice in Psalms, and three times in Deuteronomy, and here in Numbers. So it's kind of a very poetic word and not very common. That's just my point with that one. But go back, and I'm bringing up these words because there's another one too. So Moav has this dreadful fear of the people, very much. And why? What they did to the other nations, first of all. And then in verse 3, it gives because
there were many.
They were so numerous. So that's another hint. What does that remind you of?
Egypt,
yes. And in fact, the very next word, vayakots, is another word. My translation translates, they were sick with fear. Vayakots is actually, you can be sick of something. Like you're so disgusted by it. Like the people with the manna, they were so sick and tired of manna. That's the word they use for it. But it's interesting usage here because it's actually describing the fear. Or presumably in the context. You could also say they were disgusted by.
So is there another word?
Yakots. So we talked about ghoul, and now we're going to talk about vayakots. To loathe or to dread, you could say. And this also is a rare word, 8 times in the Bible. We have it first when Rebekah tells Isaac, I am sick to death, or I loathe the daughters of Het, the Hittite women. I don't want Yaakov taking a wife from there. But the one that's most interesting is a connection, like you said, to Egypt. Exodus 1:12. But the more the Egyptians oppressed them, the more they multiplied and spread. And as a result, the Egyptians loathed the Israelites. That is my translation of Exodus 1:12. And the question is it loathing in this context, or is it fearing? because in my mind, the two are quite separate. But this word can express aspects of both, possibly even putting them together. And that's why our translations put they're sick with fear. So the sick part is the loathing, and the fear is the dread. They're putting those two things together. It's all this how you choose to translate this one word. So in the Egyptian context, you have the same thing. You have a foreigner looking at Israel, seeing that they're multiplying, and they have a reaction to that. And this reaction seems to contain within it a hatred and also a fear that are tied together, right? They loathe them, but they're afraid of them. I mentioned Numbers 21:5 is where we had that same word for the manna. And then here in our passage, Numbers 22:3, Moab is overcome with fear or is sick with fear.
Also, Exodus 15:15 is describing that word.
Exodus 15:15. 15:15 is a different word. Wait, read your word in Hebrew?
No.
You don't have it? That is a different word. I know what you're talking about, the Song of the Sea. I think they use a synonym there.
Moab is no relation. It's not like Jacob and Esau.
No, it is relation to Lot. So Moab, both Bnei Amon and the Moavim come from Lot, who is Abraham's family. So they're distant relatives.
They know these people, and they know these people, so this is like family disgust.
Yeah.
Like deep disgust.
Deep disgust. Or deep fear. I mean, my point is that it's the same word, and you can choose to see it more on the one side or the other side, or a combined thing together. Well, would he necessarily know that? He wouldn't know what God had been telling Israel. They're simply seeing that Israel is numerous and has conquered several places already. And so it says Moab, all of Moab was sick with fear from Israel. It's interesting also if you look in 1 Kings 11:25, here we're talking about Aram, which is Syria, and he's saying he was Israel's enemy throughout Solomon's reign. He's talking about the king of Aram. It says in Hebrew, he was Israel's enemy. To translate, he was Satan to Israel, or he was Satan. He was an adversary to Israel all the days of Shlomo, and like Hadad, he did evil or cause a lot of trouble. And then it says, Vayakots b'Israel, and he loathed Israel, and he ruled over Aram, or over Syria. So it's interesting they use the same verb when it's dealing with nations against other nations, having that fear or that loathing.
I've got, he abhorred Israel.
He bored?
Abhorred.
Abhorred. Abhorred. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, so that's that same
abhorred
word. And then in Isaiah 7:16, the prophecy, before the child knows how to reject evil and choose what is right, the land whose two kings you fear will be desolate. Hi. It's that same word. Ha'adama asher ata katz mipnei shnei melacheha. The land before who you fear her two kings will be left. So again, in the context of kingdoms and people groups against each other, you have this abhorrence or fear. Okay, so back to our text. What is Moab's response then? Who does Moab call originally when they have this fear? Midian. It's a little bit surprising, right? Midian and Moab have fought before. They are not necessarily friendly nations, but the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so now they become friends because they're both afraid of Israel. And they say, I like all these royal communications in the Bible. They tend to be very metaphoric. And they say, look, this people is going to lick up all its surroundings. And they use a very particular word of licking. Yelachechu.
I'm going to write it down because we're going to see it again. Yelachechu. Or this is the root here. If you don't speak Hebrew, it's okay. We're just going to see that same word again.
So what does this mean? Are they going to literally, because they're so big and they have so much cattle, they're going to eat up all the pasture land? That's an option. Or is it because, you know, there's so many people, they're just going to take up all the resources? It's a metaphor for, you know, they're going to overtake us. They're going to use up our water. They're going to... This is a very big fear in a land that is so dependent on rainfall. There are not big water bodies. And so it's all a fight for survival. Okay. So, I guess the elders of Midian give the advice to send for who? Bil'am. And where does Bil'am live?
No,
he does not live in Moab. Look in verse 5. It's interesting, your English has it more specific than the Hebrew. He is son of Be'or. He lives in Petor, which is near the, you have the river?
River in the land of the sons of his people.
Okay, so Net Bible says by the Euphrates River. It's filled in which river? Because in the Hebrew it just says the river. In the land of Amor, his people. And that's curious. My Net Bible says Amau. It just translated it as if it's a name. Or the sons of the people, his people. And you could even say, if you added an N, it would be Ammon, the Ammonites. But we have in other passages in the Bible, did I write them down? I did not. Let me see if I can find it for you. We have that Petor is in Aram Naharaim. Who else is from Aram Naharaim in the Bible? Who else?
Say it again.
Aram Naharaim. Let me think what that is. I mean, who else is Aramaean in the Bible? In the think back to the patriarchs.
Abraham.
When we say every year, my father was a wandering Aramaean, who are they talking about? Abraham. Right. So Abraham's family is from Aram Naharaim. And so if Petor is near the Euphrates River, and if we compare this to the other text mentioning Bil'am, we end up with him from Aram Naharaim. So basically from Abraham's nation. That's very interesting because
what you just said, Naham Naharaim, it's not here.
Aram Naharaim, it's not here. It is in the other text of Bil'am. Let me see if I found it for you. I thought I'd written it down and I hadn't. So just wait. No, I'm going to do this.
Not the Hosea one that you were talking about.
No. Okay, Deuteronomy 23:5. If you look there, Bilam ben Beor. Oh, I guess in English it's verse 4. Deuteronomy 23, verse 4. They did not meet you with food and water on the way as you came from Egypt. And furthermore, they hired Bilam ben Beor of Petor in Aram Naharaim to curse you. Okay, wait, that isn't the one that explains it. I don't know. Okay. The name in First Chronicles, the name of the city was Dinhaba.
From Bethor of Mesopotamia.
Yeah, of Mesopotamia.
Mesopotamia, so that's good enough.
Mesopotamia is what they are translating Aram Naharaim.
Right.
I don't know. Okay, so I'm not finding my verse. We'll find it. But yeah, okay, so Aram Naharaim. Okay, so just the Aram Naharaim. I was thinking that there was one more component they added in, but maybe that's all it was. So if you string the two texts together, you get that Petor is in Aram Naharaim. And so that's Abram's homeland. And it's interesting to me because who is this person, Bilam? Who is he? He's a prophet. Everybody seems to know about him. If he's living way up in Aram Naharaim, and the people in Moab know about this prophet, or the people Midian, further south, know about this guy, that is famous. That's very famous. And yet, he hears from God. And it even says that, was it he or God says in some of the dialogues, your God. So he considers Adonai his God. So almost makes you wonder if he had a conversation with Abraham or something. Like, where is this knowledge of God from? And there's interpretation within Jewish interpretation of, you know, how is God speaking to this goy prophet? And one idea is so that the goyim don't claim later, well, we had no access to God. Like, we couldn't have known. God sent them a prophet too, so, you know, they can't make that claim of you never spoke to us.
So he's definitely not Jewish.
Right.
He's not from any of these family tribes. Like, this whole area is just one big feeding family, historically.
Right. Well, he's from Aram Naharaim, which when Abraham wants to get Isaac married, where does he send to? Our family in Aram Naharaim. So it's a long stretch, but you could say he's from the motherland in that sense. But he's not related.
Certainly not in the line of prophets.
Yeah. Not in the line of prophets, not Israelite. Right? He's a hired prophet, and he comes. And what do you notice about the numbers used in this passage?
Seven.
Interesting. Seven has always been considered in the ancient Near East. It is a number used in kind of like cultic rituals. It's considered sacred. In our Bible, it's sacred. And it can also be magical. Like in the context that's outside of the Bible, it was certainly part of their sacred magical rituals.
Where are all the sevens?
Seven altars. Seven altars. He's always building seven altars. Another nice midrash is, if you remember Moses, where did Moses live for 20 years? Midian, right? Or more than 40 years. So Moses has lived in Midian for 40 years. And when they ask the rulers of Midian what to do, they send for this guy back in Abram's homeland. But so the midrash goes that when Moab is afraid, they say, okay, so who's the ruler of that people? It's Moses. Where did he come from? Midian. So that's why they ask the Midianite elders, what to do. And they said, his power is in the words he speaks. And so they said, okay, so we have to go find someone else whose power is in the words they speak. And that's how they found Bil'am. So it's an interesting interpretation of kind of like Moses' power being his words because he speaks the word of the Lord. And so they're trying to find Bil'am, whose words are powerful, to come curse him. That's all creative interpretation, but it is dealing with the questions of why is this people group going to that one, and how did they find Bil'am? What's behind it all?
Yeah.
Yes.
Cultic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, most extra-biblical texts, when it comes to cultic practices, it involves magic. And magic involves muttering certain things. And what else is important for magic to work? It's kind of like a universal thing. If you think about fairy tales in Europe or Harry Potter, what you often need if you're trying to curse an enemy, what do you need from them? Yeah, but how does a spell work?
You need some stuff.
Yeah, some stuff?
Yeah.
There's two things usually in magic for it to work. You need to see them. You either need to see them, or you need to have a little bit of them, like their hair, or their this or that. And that works the magic. So what part of that can we see in these passages?
Oh. I mean, he
sees the very edge of the people.
I see a people dwelling alone, that's one bit. And there's the whole thing about seeing this huge quantity. I mean, we've been talking about the massive numbers and whatever,
yeah.
Whatever.
Because theoretically, he could have stayed back in Aram Naharaim
and done his magic
and
there.
Done a little curse there. But no, he had to come all the way here. Why? So he could see the people.
But
so,
what part did he have of them?
What part?
Well, he didn't have hair or a finger.
No, no. It was just the seeing.
Just
the seeing is
yeah.
is the power.
And also proximity. It's kind of like
proximity,
you know,
yeah.
The power of Jesus is distant, but usually it's only up close.
Yeah. I also find it interesting, as Christians too, we have this idea of closeness. Like, you can pray for Israel anywhere, right?
Right?
Anywhere on the earth. You can be in Australia. You can be in Greenland. But people come here and go to a prayer tower in Jerusalem. Why? It's proximity. You're close. There's something about being close to what you're talking about.
Right. Come up to Zion.
It's an interesting idea.
But I don't know if it's linked, but I've got a massive question. Can I ask you?
Okay.
Because what I kept reading all the way through, and I could not go beyond the word of the Lord. I need to hear the word of the Lord. I will only speak the word of the Lord. And God
mm-hmm.
comes to Balaam and says to him, if the man comes, you call, rise and go with him. But
yeah.
only the word which I speak to you. So he does exactly that. And then God's anger is aroused, and we have the whole donkey story.
Yeah.
And I don't.
And at the end of the donkey story, who is?
He confirms that you should go.
And he says, "Okay, I'll go back now."
Yeah.
And he says, "No, no, go with him, but only the word I speak you."
It's like he wants him really to get that point.
Yeah.
Is that what it is? Basically, you still haven't got the point.
Well, there might be two things going on. And one, you have to read between the lines because it doesn't make sense when you're reading the lines, right?
That's what I'm saying.
So, traditionally, what has been read between the lines is this, will I not honor you? He keeps saying, and he sends a better delegate. What's going on here? He's giving more and more money, right?
Getting more and more money.
Balak, king of Moab, is giving more and more money to Bil'am.
Yeah.
And that's what finally gets him to go. So the idea... Why did he say no the first time? I don't know. But eventually he says yes because there's more and more money involved. Okay, now you're offering $1 million? Okay, I'll do it. And so that is all between the lines.
If you offered me your palace and all the gold, I wouldn't come unless, you know,
I could say nothing but what the Lord tells me.
Yeah.
So he's saying, okay, but he still comes. So between the lines...
Well,
is like, I'm agreeing to come, I know you're going to pay me well, but just so you know, I can't, the results aren't guaranteed. Even if you pay me all this money, I can still only say what God tells me to.
So Balak is more at listening better and better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because not because of me, what
yeah.
I want to say is because God put it in my mouth. So he showed the responsibility to God.
And what did God tell him the very first time he asked, should I go with these people? What was the message?
No.
It was basically, you can't curse them. They're asking you to come curse them. You can't curse them because they're blessed. So he knows the answer is no in the very beginning. And yet he goes anyway because they want to honor him. They want to give him money.
So basically, he responds to their pressure rather than standing firm from the very beginning.
Right.
And saying no way.
Well, he says no way in the beginning, but then he gives in.
That's what I'm saying.
Because they keep bringing more and more money.
That maybe is why.
But then he says, okay, you want me to come? I'll come, but I still can only say what God tells me to say. So he knows that God's going to say you can't curse them. He wants the money anyway. And so he goes and he warns them, it might not turn out the way you want. Even though you paid me all this money, you might not get your results.
I'm still baffled by the donkey story. Because the donkey story implies that he knew from the beginning that the answer is no, and yet, as the pressure comes on and he gets offered more money or whatever, he says, okay, I'll come as long as I only say...
But he does seem to get a confirmation from God, okay, you can go.
That's right.
Yeah.
So he goes in the morning.
And then he gets angry.
Yeah.
And then God gets angry, and that's my question, and I'm puzzled.
Well, it is puzzling, and that's why you're forced to read between the lines.
Okay.
The story is asking you to read between the lines. You could say God said it sarcastically. You could say God said it trusting that he already knew God's real will was to bless the people, and there's no way you can go against that. Seems like Bilam and God both knew this after the first meeting. But now he's giving him permission to go, and he wants to confirm to Bilam along the way, make him afraid enough of God that no matter what, he will still only say exactly what God says. Because there is that fear that humans will buckle under pressure. Once he's there, he's going to give a prophecy that's not of God.
Because it's dangerous to do otherwise.
Yeah. So maybe the donkey is to make sure he remembers only what I say. And at that point, when Bilam wants to go home, he says, well, go ahead and go. I think because he wants the kings to realize a message. If Bilam never goes, the kings don't realize that the people of Israel are blessed. So for that whole message to be conveyed all the way, he has to allow him to go and be unsuccessful, basically. And for Bilam, it's hard because if you're a very, very famous prophet, and then you go and you can't do something, you appear unsuccessful, that might damage your reputation, right? And so it better be a lot of money because he may be living off that money the rest of his life. He may not get another job. So he has an angel, he has a donkey. And he's like Moses, he gets angry and he beats his donkey. Moses beats the rock, he beats a donkey. Three times though, instead of two. Okay, so let's skip down. The city of Moab. Maybe it's on the Arnon River we mentioned before. Okay, so we have his first... How many sacrifices does he do?
Seven.
But the first time, what happens? Well, I guess he does, he already gets, that's just the instruction. So he does the first time he gets a word from God. And we only get half of it. Okay. So let's go over. We talked a bit about some of these poetic ways of hearing. We talked about the metaphor of licking up the earth. And now we're going to go read Micah 7:16. Now, Micah, hundreds of years later, but let's say 8th century Judah, right? That's Micah's time. And here is Micah's message. In verse 12, it mentions, in that day, people will come to you from Assyria as far as Egypt, from Egypt as far as the Euphrates River. And it's interesting because in the Hebrew, it says, from Ashur, which is Assyria, and the cities of Matsor, which they're taken as Mitzrayim. Matsor is actually a siege. So it doesn't literally have the word Egypt, but it's understood to be Egypt. Maybe it's a play on its name. And from Matsor until the river.
Where are you?
I'm in Micah 7, verse 12, to give us a context.
All right.
Until the river. And so my translation says Euphrates River. It's filling in the details for clarity. But it's just interesting, the Hebrew is very vague. And then from sea to sea, from mountain to mountain. So sea to sea, what seas are we talking about? Mountain to mountain? What mountain? I don't know. Oh, sorry. Miyam vehar hahar, and mountain of mountains. Okay. And the earth will become desolate because of what the inhabitants have done. Okay, then shepherd your people with a shepherd's rod. I'm skipping down to verse 14. Allow them to graze in Bashan and Gilad. Both of these places are the places we're dealing with in this text in Numbers. As they did in the days of old. Okay, now we're getting close to our verses here. As in the days when you departed from the land of Egypt, I will show you miraculous deeds. Nations will see this and be disappointed by all their strength. They will put their hands over their mouths and act as if they were deaf.
Now we've got it.
It's kind of strange, yeah? They will lick the dust like a snake.
It's the same word.
It's the same word of lick. Yelahachu. And it is not, there's, lelakek is the other word for lick. So it's a specific word for lick. And it's the same one we have in our story. Of like the oxen licks up all the grass. Here, they're like a snake licking up the dirt. Like serpents crawling on the ground. They will come trembling from strongholds to the Lord our God. They will be terrified of you. Now, none of those are the same words for fear that we were talking about, but similar. There is no other God like you. And here's the interesting thing. They're terrified of you. There's no other God like you. And why? What is God's defining characteristic? In verse 18, Nose avon ve'over al pesha. You forgive sin and pardon the rebellion. Or for rebellion, you could translate the willful sins of those who remain among your people. Or just the remnant of your inheritance. You do not remain angry forever, but delight in showing loyal love.
What's the word that here? Hang on. What's the word here for I've got transgression, passing over the transgression.
Yes, so that would be pesha.
Pesha. But you said
avon, they usually translate iniquity. And pesha.
You use the word.
Rebellion is what the Net Bible
merit.
Has.
Oh, I see. But it's not merit.
It's not merit. It's pesha.
Pesha.
Pesha is a sin that you knew it was a sin and you did it anyway.
Right.
That's what pesha is. Avon is more generic. It could be something you just have a weakness for. Like you can get the avon from your parents. You can apparently be unaware of it as well as aware of it. I'm not sure where exactly the lines are fuzzy between the two, but pesha is purposeful. Okay. So our big link here is just, so far, is this word of licking. And it's a general picture of the nations being afraid of what God is doing with his people. And yet, what are they fearing here? Is it conquering of territory, or is it something else? What is it that they're actually fearing of how God is working with the people? He's doing good things. He's forgiving. That is like the pinnacle. Like who can forgive? Right? You do not remain angry forever, but delight in showing loyal love. Like this is a total different kind of God than everybody else is used to. You will once again have mercy on us. You will conquer our evil deeds. And I like that. There are some other translations that kind of take that away. If you don't follow the Masoretic version, some say they have a sin instead of a sheen there. So the idea of washing away. But I like the Masoretic text, yichbosh. It means to conquer. And what conquers our sins? Or who conquers our sins?
God.
Because he has mercy. In the same way that his mercy, in other places, you know the word hesed? Sometimes we translate it grace, mercy. It should be like a loyal love. It's a love that's God's kind of love. It's loyalty. What does that do in Psalm 117? Do you remember the psalm? Hallelujah et Adonai kol goyim. All the nations praise the Lord. Why?
Because his faithfulness or his love endures forever.
It says, Ki gavar alenu hasdo. His grace has beaten us, in the sense of has won, conquered us. Ligbor is like when you have two battles and one wins. That's the word they're using. So God's mercy wins over us. I don't know why we don't translate that metaphor more exactly in English. I forget, what do you have, by the way, for Psalm 117? What kind of translations do you have? Psalm 117? Isn't that the right one?
Yeah, it's verse 2.
Yeah, what does yours have?
So this is just this is
towers. Towers over us. Okay.
I've got it. Oh, 17. His merciful kindness is great towards us. And the truth of the Lord endures forever.
So I have to figure out why they don't translate it as is victorious over us. Because when we teach biblical Hebrew, we're always trying to find a good word for winning in a battle. Because there's not... The same word we use today is not the one they use in the Bible. And one of the ways you can say that someone is victorious is to use hu gavar.
Gavar, yeah.
He was stronger, he was bigger, he was greater. He won. And so this is what the chesed does against us. And I just think that's a beautiful picture. And therefore, in Micah 7:19, when God comes back and he's going to have mercy on us, he is going to conquer our iniquities. I have that same picture that his grace can win. It beats even our sins.
But I've got chesed.
Where do you have chesed? In Psalms.
In Micah.
No. Oh, yes, there is chesed also.
Micah, Rega.
Because he loves chesed. He loves loyal love. And right after that in 19, you will once again have mercy on us. You will conquer our evil deeds. You will hurl our sins into the depths of the sea. That is the same metaphor of you see this soldier basically winning, fighting our evil deeds, picking them up and hurling them into the sea.
I've got no fishing written next to it.
No fishing?
No, me.
Oh, no fishing. That's good. Yeah, don't go fishing.
Yeah, don't go fishing.
Especially not in the depths of the sea. That's a dangerous place to be.
Yeah, put your sins down there. Don't go looking for them.
And it's interesting. He will give his truth or loyalness to Jacob and extend his loyal love, his chesed, to Abraham. And in our passage, we are also talking about the descendants of Jacob and Abraham, which you promised on oath to our ancestors in ancient times. So that's a connection, and I think it's actually quite beautifully fitting, because you have this big people that God has caused to multiply after all the ways that they have left God and not obeyed him, and yet it's his grace, and that's so apparent. Like here in Micah, the other people are afraid because of the grace that God gives his people, because that shows who God is, who his character is. They're not simply afraid because the people's so big they're going to conquer them, because Egypt and Assyria are much greater nations than Israel. They're the superpowers of the day. So numerically, there is no advantage to Israel. But what they are going to be afraid of is God's loyalty. And that is an amazing little passage to me. So really quickly, before we go downstairs, we'll just glance at Isaiah 65. Then you will look and smile. You will be excited and your heart will swell with pride. From the riches of distant lands. From the riches of distant lands will belong to you, and the wealth of nations will come to you. And it actually even mentions fear here in the Hebrew, which it is changed kind of to excitement. There are similarities, right? When you're afraid and when you're excited, there's that adrenaline. So I don't know, I guess you could say a thrill. So
pachad.
It's pachad here, yeah. And so the riches of the goyim are going to come to you. So there's our connection in the sense that Bil'am and all these people they represent the goyim. And Bil'am is getting rich in the one case. But here, it's Israel. And you notice, camel caravans will cover your roads, young camels from Midian and Ephah. So Midian down south, they have the trade routes for the spices, and they ride camels. All the merchants of Shva will come, which is on the other side, past Egypt, bringing golden incense and singing praises to the Lord. All the sheep of Kedar will be gathered to you. Where's Kedar? Midian. They will go up on my altar acceptably, and I will bestow honor on my majestic temple. So here is this picture of all the nations honoring the Lord by bringing these gifts to the temple, and the foreigners rebuilding their walls, and kings serving.
And it goes on. The ships of Tarshish will come first.
Yeah.
Their silver and their gold.
So these two, the focus is actually the reverse of what we read in Numbers 22, where they're taking certain themes. One had a verbal link to Micah, and then a general link of the nations being afraid. And yet it's a completely different context, or it's a more subtle kind of fear. And then Isaiah, you have the nations coming and bringing gifts. So that sense, what was written between the lines in the Bil'am story about bringing gifts and honoring. What is honoring? Honoring is giving gifts. And you have that right here in Isaiah 65. So this connection of giving gifts, a mention of Midian. And so some of these is kind of an artistic link that they've made together. But I will also say, you might say, well, that's fine, you know, you like to interpret between the lines, blah, blah, blah. Let's go quickly to the New Testament. Bil'am is mentioned in the New Testament 3 times, all in negative contexts. the story we read, he's hearing from God, and he actually, in the end, does what God says. He can't curse Israel. But according to interpretation, let's hear what he does. 2 Peter 2:15. By forsaking the right path, they have gone astray because they followed the way of Bilam, son of, here it says Bosor, it should be Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. So what did he like?
2 Peter what?
2 Peter 2:15.
So he likes the money that he's been given by.
He likes the money that he's got unrighteously, basically. There's that concept there. Mm-hmm. So he loves money. We know that from 2 Peter 2:15. Jude, that little book, one chapter, Jude verse 11, woe to them, for they have traveled down Cain's path, and because of greed have abandoned themselves to Bilam's error. Hence they will certainly perish in Korah's rebellion. So here we have three biblical characters brought up, but Bilam is associated with what?
Greed.
And
it makes sense of all your reading between the lines, doesn't it?
That makes sense. Some other people were reading between the lines also. And Revelation 2:14. But I have a few things against you. You have some people there who follow the teaching of Bilam, who instructed Balak to put a stumbling block before the people of Israel so they would eat food sacrificed to idols and commit sexual immorality. Nice. Where do we get that from? It's not in the text, guys. It's between the lines. It's between the lines at the end. We'll get it after the summer. After the summer, we'll get it. It's simply the juxtaposition of two stories. Bilam has all his oracles, and immediately after that, the daughters of Moab go out to seduce Israel. And so the interpretation goes, okay, I'm not allowed to curse Israel, but if you want them to go down, this is what they need to do. They need to be unfaithful to their God. So why don't you send your women out to convince them to idolatry, basically, which in fertility cults usually involves sexual unions for the sake of fertility. And so you have idolatry and sexual immorality going together. And of course, idolatry in the Bible is often a metaphor is used to represent the idolatry of sexual immorality and being unfaithful. Right. So they can be literal and it can be figurative, and the two are one. No pun intended. So that whole, what's written for you straight between the eyes in Revelation 2:14 is not written in the Old Testament story, but it is there between the lines, and it is there in Jewish interpretation. And so you can see that in Jesus' day, people are reading their Bible and understanding it, and this is the accepted interpretation of the Bilam stories in that day. So
that tried to put the fear of the Lord in, but
yeah. So we are left, what actually happened to Bilam? Was he purely evil? Was he purely greedy? Was there a good side? Because it's ambiguous in the first story. But how he is remembered is because of this. Because after he delivered these beautiful oracles, which are even messianic in nature, he succumbed to his own greed. I guess you could compare him, if you've read Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, all those books, you could compare him to Gollum. If you remember, they say he may serve a purpose yet. And however, in the end, he succumbed to his own greed. So there was good in him. He did serve purposes, but then in the end, there was greed. So with that, we will have a break for the summer. And don't succumb to greed.
I've said, hang on, wait. You've got to wait 4 weeks before you get to the sunshine.